Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. When we don't feel well, we can go to the doctor, who might ask us, "Tell me where it hurts." Our answers can offer crucial information and clues about what's wrong and help lead the doctor to an accurate diagnosis. But what happens if the very part of us that's hurt is the organ that produces awareness, sensation, and generates speech? What happens when the source of what's wrong is the brain? It poses a huge challenge and sets up a complex riddle for doctors, or more specifically, for neurologists who have to search more or less in the dark for clues about what's wrong. This is the subject of a fascinating new book co-written by Alan Roper, a clinical neurologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School. He's credited with founding the field of neurological intensive care here in Boston. His new book is called Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole. A renowned neurologist explains the mystery and drama of brain disease, and he's with us now, and welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you, Alan Roper.
Thanks so much for having us.
Also with us is Dr. Roper's co-author, Brian David Burrell. He teaches mathematics and statistics at UMass Amherst and is author of Postcards from the Brain Museum. Welcome to you as well. It's great to have you, Brian.
Thank you.
So, listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Have you or a family member suffered from brain disease? Did it affect your personality, your speech, your sense of reality? How do you think neurology has changed, and where do you see it going here in the future? What questions do you have? These are two folks who can answer a lot of them. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And I'll start with you, Alan Roper. I'd just love to get you to talk a little bit about, and I think the sort of first question is contained in the title, Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole. How is neurology similar to the story of Alice in Wonderland? I mean, why this metaphor?
Well, when the brain becomes diseased, the essential features of being human are altered in a big way. And to get at that, you've got to go after things that are bizarre and unusual, almost like Alice falling down the rabbit hole and being in a world that has mirrors and kaleidoscopic visions. In order to get at that, the craft of neurology involves a number of peculiar tricks and ways of having one brain talk to another when the bad brain can't give you the information you need.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a really, as we alluded to in the introduction, that's a sort of key piece of information or strategy, I guess, that doctors would rely on. I mean, getting the patient to talk to you about what's going on with them.
That's quite right. I mean, an individual whose language, for example, is altered, who has aphasia, is not able to relate what's wrong, how they're feeling, and their comprehension is similarly off. So having a conversation with them is a little bit like Alice talking to the Red Queen.
Right. So are there still clues that you can get from the language, or what are you doing when you're actually talking to someone and trying to figure out what's going on in their brain when something has clearly gone wrong?
Well, there are many ways to get at it, sometimes obliquely by asking things that are themselves absurd. The original title of this book for Brian and me was, Do Helicopters Eat Their Young?
Right, and this is a question you actually asked a patient once.
That's right. Yeah. And we ask actually things like that repeatedly. Is it warmer in the summer or the south? Yeah. Because if you get it, then all of your faculties are clicking. And the way you answer indicates exactly where and what is wrong with the brain function.
Now, Brian Burrell, tell me about the genesis of the book. How did you team up with Dr. Roper to write it? What was the idea here?
It came about somewhat accidentally. About 5 years ago, I got an invitation to a book club meeting. It was the neurology group, the residents at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And the book club was meeting at Alan's house. And it was somewhat fortuitous that the meeting happened to be during spring break out at UMass. And so almost on a lark, I decided to show up where I met about 40 doctors who had just read Postcards from the Brain Museum. And that's when I met Alan. And he invited me to the hospital after that first meeting. And we gradually started talking about the idea of maybe doing a book. Initially, I was a little bit skeptical, but I had done research into the history of neurology. I already had an interest. And it was finally when he asked me to accompany him on a service, a two-week service at the hospital to go on the ward, the ICU and the neuro inpatient ward. that I finally said to him, Alan, I think we have a book here. Mm. I think.
And what struck you about that initial visit and doing the rounds with him in the ICU? What struck you that gave you confidence that there was a book here?
Two things struck me immediately, and one is the intensity of the workday for the neurology team. There really isn't any downtime. We're talking about a group of anywhere from 6 to 8 people going from bedside to bedside and getting medical test results and discussing patients at length. And then, of course, there were the patients themselves. Every room you walked into, someone had a different story. Mm-hmm. Someone, it turned out, had worked at Polaroid in the 70s. Someone else was a chemist. Someone ran a drapery store up on the North Shore, something like that. So the intriguing thing about the neurological cases to me is that it was absolutely necessary to get at the heart of who these people were, to get some idea of their background, family history, not just to go in and look at a bunch of tests and say, well, you know, take this pill or you need a certain type of surgery. It really got it to the heart of who these people were.
Mm. This is what I took away. One of the things I took away, Alan Roper, from your book is, and that is, I mean, I'm sure that every doctor would say it's important to listen to your patients and really get to know them. But it seems like you really need to do that as a neurologist.
Well, it's true because the way in which the personality and affect goes wrong is exactly where the diagnosis is. So to sort out who an individual is to begin with, hear from their family, see how that gets derailed, is the diagnostic process itself. You can't ask a liver that.
Yeah.
Or
right.
a stomach. But the brain, you can ask.
So interesting. Tell me why neurology is called the queen of medical specialties.
Well, we take liberties by calling it that. I'm sure some of my colleagues would demur. but it is. I mean, look, it's very elegant. It's historically bound. Many of the tricks of the trade that we use today are 150 years old, and they're still extremely valuable. But it has to do with the subtlety of being at the bedside and not looking at the tests. The value added is the physician, him or herself, and that individual's ability to synthesize what's going on without a lot of fancy tests and so on. And generally, those are as misleading as not.
Mm. But isn't that, I mean, I'm just curious, wouldn't that be good advice for any doctor in any field?
I think increasingly medicine, both because of secular pressure and a need to move people through the hospital, as well as everyone's desire for certainty in diagnosis, has made the tests paramount.
Yeah.
The scans, the blood tests, the x-rays, spinal taps, so forth. But in neurology, the farther you get away from the essential elements of the patient and their illness, that duality, mm-hmm. the less likely you are to be able to help them. I'm not sure that's still true in the rest of medicine, which is not to say that people aren't compassionate, interested in the patient as an individual, and so forth. But there's an extra dimension when it comes to the brain.
Mm. You know, Brian, you mentioned just how fast decisions have to be made and how much sort of action there is in the intensive care unit that Dr. Roper works in. And I took that away from the book, and I wondered. And I don't know who, either one of you can tell the story, but there are many stories in the book that are really sort of hair-raising. And I'll just bring up one. She was Mrs. G. She had hydrocephalus, which is basically water builds up and puts pressure on the brain, right? So tell us what happened and how that was resolved. And it was the result of a pretty quick decision on your part, Dr. Roper.
Yeah, it's probably it's representative, but it was pretty dramatic. There was a woman who had been in and out of the hospital numerous times with bad headaches, difficulty walking, sleepiness, all symptoms of the condition you mentioned, hydrocephalus, and the cause was not clear. There was some kind of inflammation at the base of her brain that prevented the fluid from draining properly. And we had seen her in the morning, and everybody was looking at her scans, but nobody had really examined her carefully and noticed the subtle signs that the pressure inside her skull was increasing. And the next thing we heard, we were sitting in our little conference room going over some charts, and there was an arrest, cardiac arrest called. And I knew immediately it was her. It was about 60 yards away, so we were able to run in and see her heart had stopped. And the so-called code team was in there banging on her chest in the graphic way that is shown on television. Because of experience with similar situations, I knew it was not her heart or lungs that were at fault. It was the increased pressure in her head. And the only solution to getting her heart to start again would be to drain that pressure.
Right.
So we had a wonderful young neurosurgical resident, young lady, who was well known to me because my son was the chief resident in neurosurgery at the time. And she dutifully pulled out the little kit and put a tube in the brain, and the water spurted right over my shoulder onto the wall,
right,
and her heart started again.
Right, and not to be too graphic, but I will be because you wrote about this in the book. I mean, getting a tube in the brain so that liquid would spurt out literally means drilling a hole.
That's right. Little hole with a hand drill if it's done at the bedside.
Yeah. Brian Borrell, I'm wondering if you can tell a story. I mean, something that you witnessed that really sort of brings home the drama and the sort of the exclamation point of what's involved in this craft.
The story that springs to mind immediately is one that involved not so much drama as a little bit of, I hate to say comic relief, but it was relief compared to some of the other cases in the ward. There are cases of people who are not necessarily sick in the sense they don't have a neurological problem, but they have a problem that's manifesting itself in some way. And in one case, there was a case of a drug seeker. Now, this was initially somewhat questionable, but this is someone who shows up in intense pain and wants some relief in the form of intravenous drugs. And I noticed, this was entirely new to me, but I picked up on the fact that the team was skeptical about this. Dr. Roper wasn't particularly skeptical initially, but the team members were rolling their eyes, and this patient was a young guy doing a pretty good impression, if it was an impression, of excruciating pain. So the discussion began around, what do you do? How do you treat this person? Do you just immediately give drugs? There's some tests that can be done. But for me personally, later that day, having had sciatic pain myself, I knew what potentially he was dealing with. But I was leaving the hospital at the end of the day, and I happened to see this fellow downstairs outside of Aubon Pan in the lobby. And he was laughing it up with some friends. He was perched on the edge of a couch. He was clearly not in any pain whatsoever.
Busted.
And, well, he was. And I mentioned the story because it was one contribution I was able to make. I'm not a medical doctor, but I was embedded with the team, as it were. And the next morning, this patient was discussed at morning report. And the conclusion had pretty much been reached by the team, but I was able to make it conclusive for them and say, oh, by the way, I saw him down in the lobby.
My rejoinder to that, though, is that people suffer, and pain and things like that are subjective. It's very, very hard to be sure.
Yeah,
there is a coda to that story that I noticed that very day, because the team members, of course, get a laugh out of this. But Dr. Roper was very quick to interject and say there are a lot of different forms of suffering. And just because someone doesn't have a neurological condition that we can put our finger on doesn't mean this person doesn't have a problem or isn't suffering in some way. And it is the duty of the team, of the residents, to see their way forward and try to help this person out because it's disruptive. It's disruptive to his life and his family's life.
Sure. Listeners, we're talking to Dr. Alan Roper and Brian David Borrell. They're co-authors of Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole, A Renowned Neurologist Explains the Mystery and Drama of Brain Disease. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions about this, if you have a family member, if you yourself suffered from brain disease. Tell us about your experience. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Sandy, who's calling from Brockton. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just called. I got in my car and heard about the brain illnesses, and I have something, my own personal experience. In 2008, I developed encephalitis, an infection in my brain, and I was in the hospital for about a week. I also work for the Department of Mental Health, and I'm a clinical social worker, and something that I found very interesting was it could have gone either way when I went in the hospital with the encephalitis. My presentation could have been perceived as some sort of psychotic episode. I mean, I was screaming, yelling, swearing, hitting, kicking. I could have been sent to a psych hospital, but for the fact my husband was there and was able to explain that I'd had pneumonia and I wasn't on any sort of drugs, anything like that. And I just found that very interesting on both sides of it, from the psychology and looking at how that presents and then the infection. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Sandy, thanks so much for putting that on the table. And Dr. Roper, you were nodding your head listening to Sandy. I mean, what did you hear there?
Well, there's a story in the book about the now somewhat infamous connection between ovarian cysts or teratomas and psychosis. The distinction between what we call mental disease in the modern era and brain or neurological disease is an artifice, right? It's all one brain that's got to be doing this. And diseases that affect nerve cells produce mental disorders, produce paralysis, produce difficulty with speech. It's one package. And neurology and psychiatry were once a unified specialty. We're split apart by psychoanalysis and psychodynamics, and are now reemerging as one entity. Hmm. So a kind of story like that is not at all unusual.
Really interesting. Let's go to Julia, who's calling from Winthrop. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi. My mother has been suffering from trigeminal neuralgia, and I just think this particular disease is one of those ones where it's so many complex things happening, symptoms, manifestations, and then trying to figure out the right treatment regime. I wonder if you could just touch on a disease like that where it affects multiple aspects of a person's life.
Sure, Julia. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. Dr. Roper, first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about what that sickness is?
Trigeminal neuralgia is a severe, almost maniacally bad pain in one part of the face or the cranium, usually the middle of the face, sometimes the forehead or jaw. And it occurs intermittently as a very severe, abrupt twinge, probably 10 out of 10 on the pain scale, making people sometimes drop to their knees. And there can be a little bit of an after effect as well. It's one of the diseases in which there's a big discrepancy between the severity of the underlying problem and the experience of the patient.
I see.
Pain is unbelievably severe. There are several varieties of it. One of them is now treatable by surgery, which is a relatively novel thing. But for the most part, it's controlled with medications, and a small proportion of people really can't be controlled and have to eventually have the nerve cut. So it's a common disease. It's commoner in elderly and older individuals, more in women than men. Very severe pain.
Julia, thank you for your call. And again, we're sorry about your mother dealing with what sounds like a real challenge there. Let's go to Lauren, who's calling from Charlestown. Lauren, you're on the air. Do we have Lauren? Perhaps not. Here's something I want to ask you about that I was really struck by, Dr. Roper, and that is, you know, there's a word that sounds so kind of normal that we use all the time, but it turns out it's the word confusion. And you said that, you write that there's so much we don't know about confusion, and that it's something that, you know, we really think about medically and what it means.
Well, it raises the question of, what is it to be coherent? What's not confusion? What is it that we are every day? And why are we the same in the morning when we wake up as we were when we went to sleep before? We don't miss a beat. Our memories are there. Our continuity of thoughts and ideas are there. It's very easy to disrupt the flow of that internal conversation.
Right.
And when that's disrupted, the patient behaves in a confused manner. There are a lot of ways to produce that confusion. So medications, sleep deprivation, trauma, and a large number of brain diseases. But what it actually entails is tough to get your arms around. And we struggle with that in neurology because it's a manifestation of an opening shot of so many disorders.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I'd love to ask you, Brian Burrell, too, about this idea of confusion, and if you sort of what you saw in sort of being embedded here, examples of that, and what it led to, what it indicates.
Well, we had a rather dramatic juxtaposition of two patients on the ward, both of whom were confused and in very different ways. We have a guy who we call Wally in the book, and very interesting guy, very talkative guy, who at times was very precise about things. He had been a chemist at one point. He knew some scientific formulas. He knew the chemical composition of acetone and so on. But then he would lapse into some very strange behaviors. He actually thought Dr. Roper was two different doctors. And we would ask him about this, and in a very sort of rational, reasoned way, he says, well, you're this doctor, but you're also this Dr. Sanjanista. And he would go on and on about this. And his was a case that we were finally able to resolve by looking at his family history. This is, you know, when I say we, by the way, I mean the team,
sure,
not me.
But you were there.
I was there, yes. And next door to him was another patient, Gordon, who I really took to immediately. He was a real Boston kind of guy, a South Shore kind of guy, and he spoke very well, somewhat eloquently, but none of it made any sense.
Well, a lot of these stories are in, all these stories are in the book, Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole, A Renowned Neurologist Explains the Mystery and Drama of Brain Disease. Dr. Alan Roper is a professor at Harvard Medical School and a clinician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Roper, thank you so much. And Brian Burrell teaches math and statistics at UMass Amherst. Thank you as well, Brian.
Very welcome.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the playwright Eve Ensler comes up with a new play, Obsessive Political Correctness. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.